There's a nursery rhyme that goes, "Pussycat, pussycat, where have you been? I've been to London to see the Queen. Pussycat, pussycat, what did you there? I frightened a mouse under a chair." Do you think it's possible that on our way to meet Queen Theosophia, we've been distracted by theoretical mice under chairs? Blavatsky claims she wrote The Secret Doctrine to appeal to the higher faculties, or the inner faculties, those faculties beyond the intellect. She warned we couldn't get it in words, but we've been doing that, we thought. She and her adept teachers warned strongly against dogmatism, turning the theories into a belief system. And in a letter to Mrs. Besson in 1900, the last one we feel certain K.H. wrote, to a Westerner at least, he said, "The TS and its members are slowly developing a creed. Creed ends in hypocrisy." In The Voice of the Silence, Blavatsky said that the doctrine of the I, that is the intellectual understanding, is dangerous without the soul wisdom illuminating it. She wasn't against intellect. She said theosophy is for those who can think. But intellect alone can become even evil. Don't you think that's true? Look around at brilliant people who are self-centered, greedy, and downright evil. Intellect alone is important. Intellect is important, but alone it can become dangerous. Now, after her death, I believe it was Mrs. Besson, found among her papers a little piece, which was mentioned earlier here, that has always been called "There Is a Road" because it had no title. It reads, "There is a road steep and thorny, beset with perils of every kind, but yet a road, and it leads to the very heart of the universe. I can tell you how to find those who will show you the secret gateway that opens inwardly only and closes fast behind the neophyte forevermore. There is no danger that dauntless courage cannot overcome. There is no trial that spotless purity cannot pass through. There is no difficulty that strong intellect cannot surmount. For those who win onward, there is reward past all telling, the power to bless and save humanity. For those who fail, there are other lives in which success may come." So beautiful, so clear. She tells it like it is. She's no doomsday prophet, and she's no Pollyanna. She says, this is going to be tough, but you can do it because you're human. That's why you can do it, not because you're a member of some society, this or any other. Now, "There is a road" simply points toward a spiritual path. It highlights the possibilities and the hardships, the hardships and the possibilities of overcoming them. The road or the path or the journey is often used as a metaphor for life, isn't it? Somebody takes one path, somebody takes another path. It's used frequently to mean a way of life, isn't it? But that way of life is useless unless lived. The theories are like maps. They're very important, and they're very useful. But some members and some people of all kinds of traditions know the map from one side to the other, and they've never gotten up out of their chair. The map is not the place the map represents. And it doesn't look like the map either. We hear about a place. I was the guest of the United States Army between the Korean and Vietnam Wars, and I was in Korea in a little town called Tongdushan. I can tell you about that town. It was pathetically poor. The roads were dirt. When it rained, it was mud. The shops were little kiosks with meat hanging on hooks and flies all over them, with a railroad going through the center of the town, and whoever wrote there, "The Bear Went Over the Mountain," wrote it in Korea, because there was a mountain after mountain after mountain. You have a picture, don't you? If you went there, would it look like your picture? No. No. We get a picture from the theories. But the reality is not the picture we form in our mind, because we form the picture out of what we already know, don't we? This is true of all of us. I frequently say when I give a talk, I'm not talking down to anybody. I'm talking about what happened to me. And I assume because I'm human and you're human, it's happened to you too. We're all in this thing together, whatever it is. So the road is a metaphor for life. Now, that metaphorical road that H.P.B. mentions has been spoken about in the great religious traditions of the world. In Plato's cave analogy, most of you probably know that. You remember there were people chained in a cave looking at shadows on the wall. To them, that was the reality. There wasn't anything else. They couldn't see anything else. They just saw the shadows. One brave soul got loose. He climbed up to the outside. Very difficult trip, if you can call it a trip. Scraped his knees, maybe broke a few bones. Very hard. He got out, was blinded by the true light. And when he realized what we thought was real is but shadows of reality, he was overjoyed. He went back to tell everyone and was duly murdered for telling the truth. Every pioneer of every movement is martyred, either literally or figuratively, aren't they? The women's rights movement, they put women in jail because they wanted to vote. Seems absurd now, but it didn't back in the early 20th century. Blavatsky was martyred in many ways. The gay movement, you name any movement, any human movement where somebody defies the worldview, you'll find that they get martyred. So in Christianity, that road has been called the way of the cross. In Judaism, the way of holiness. In Buddhism, it's the Eightfold Path. In every one of these, action is required. At one point in the New Testament, Jesus says, "Everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' is not getting into the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father." Action is required, not belief in theories. So, what is this way of life, then, that we need to live? It's, Blavatsky says that at one point, one of the adepts, masters, remember master means teacher, not God. Masters that we know of in the letters are human beings who do not live forever. One of the masters gave her a little piece which was a succinct guide to living this life. Very short, and you could spend years thinking about the meaning of every little statement in that piece. Part of it, it reads, begins, a clean, it's called the Golden Stairs. The beginning is a clean life. This is what's required for the spiritual life according to this adept. A clean life, a pure heart, an eager intellect, an unveiled spiritual perception, a brotherliness for one's co-disciple, and further on, a courageous endurance of personal injustice. Wow, that's really difficult. And Blavatsky had a hard time with that one. But after a courageous endurance of personal injustice, a brave declaration of principles. Don't just stand there and let them tell you nonsense without saying what you believe to be true. The greatest example of this is in the ancient world is Socrates. He refused to escape his fate, personal injustice. If he just lied and said he didn't believe what he believed, he would have been free. He had a brave declaration for principles and a courageous endurance of personal injustice. And who do we remember now? His accusers? Only the Greek philosophers, the Greek professors know who they were. Nobody else does. We remember Socrates. So, a brave declaration of principles and a valiant defense of those who are unjustly attacked. That's hard also. Because you know perfectly well that sometimes if you're defending someone who's unjustly attacked, you will be the next victim. They will turn on you. Are you strong enough? No wonder nobody wants to do this. Doesn't sound very appetizing. So that's some clues as to how or what is required if we're to live this life, this spiritual life, and come to the heart of the universe. In one sense, there are just two roads that people follow. The common one is the sensate one, the road of our feelings and our thoughts. We identify with our feelings and thoughts and body, don't we really? I mean, let's face it. We believe in Atma, Buddhi, Manas, and all the rest of it, but when it comes right down to it, I am this. The me, what we think of as the me. That's the common road. It is not wrong. There's nothing question of right and wrong. It's choices. If we choose that road, which the vast majority does because it's easier, you go around, you're aiming for the mountaintop. You go around the side ever so slowly. In the city, we arrogant New Yorkers speak of New York as the city. When I walk back from the TS, which is up on 53rd Street in the east side, I go through Grand Central because it's easier, and I go over to Madison Avenue, which is just before 5th. It's steep incline for about 3 blocks. Or I could take the easier route across 42nd Street and up 5th Avenue and not quite notice the steepness. Well, I brave the steep incline and get there quicker. So the common route is that route across 42nd and up 5th Avenue. It's easier. And you learn as you go, but ever so slowly, ever so slowly. The other one is that road that has been metaphorized in legend, myth, and talked about in spiritual literature, the primary literature of the TS, the secondary literature of the TS. That road is like the road that Mozart talks about, although he doesn't call it a road, in the Magic Flute, the opera The Magic Flute. Most of you are probably familiar with The Magic Flute. The prince is willing to go through all kinds of terrible trials meeting dragons, fire, whatever. I don't know all that much about the opera, but you know there are many legends where they have to meet a dragon and they have to slay the dragon and they have to do this. And it's at the danger of life that they're taking this trip. And what does the prince want? He wants to find that beautiful woman who represents wisdom. That's what he's seeking. Papageno takes, he's a bird catcher who's with him, he takes one look at that and said, "You're not going to get me to do that. No, thank you. You can go on your own. I'm not going. All I want is a nice glass of wine and a good meal and a nice wife." Papageno isn't wrong. He's taking the longer, easier route. So now it says that the less traveled road, this less traveled one, she said, "Show you the gateway that opens inwardly only and closes fast behind the neophyte forevermore." So that gate opens inwardly to our thoughts, our feelings, our beliefs, but it opens to a lot more than that. It opens to the inner reality, the inner self, the spark that was spoken of in previous talks here, the spark of the from the eternal flame. But we must be careful with that metaphor, because it's not the kind of spark that leaps out from a log burning in the fireplace. That spark becomes a separate entity, doesn't it? It's not that. The spark that you and I are is the flame. It's in the flame. It is the flame. It's a locus within the flame, a point within the flame. It is not separate from the flame. You and I ultimately are the flame. That flame is at the heart of the universe. And as Stefan so wonderfully did when he gave his talk and became passionate about it, that's what we're here for. That's what we're doing. We're trying to awaken that spark within, that inner self, which until it's awakened doesn't exist for us. It simply doesn't exist. When we have an insight, have you noticed, just think in your own experience, you'll be struggling with an idea perhaps. You don't understand it. You don't get it. One minute you do not know, and the next minute you know. And there's no measurable time between the two. So what you didn't know was non-existent to you until that flash of understanding. Isn't that true? And it's like that with the inner self. So if the gate opening inwardly was just to our ordinary me, it doesn't close fast forevermore, does it? We can change ourselves. We do. Sometimes we have traumatic experiences that change us. As we get older, some of our friends say, "You've mellowed out," or "You've become more wretched than you were before." You go through psychoanalysis and you are changed, aren't you? If you change yourself, the analyst can't do it. I had a friend years ago. He went to an analyst like he went to the local deli. "Here's my money, where's my cure?" Doesn't work that way. It just, I'm not making this up. I wish I were, but that's how it is. So the gate that opens inwardly can't be a gate to the me, because that changes all the time. That can't close fast forevermore because it changes all the time, see? We can go in and out. The gate that closes behind us forevermore is not a gate to self-analysis. It's not a gate to theories, not even theosophical theories. It's a gate that opens to a totally new state of consciousness, an awareness you did not have before. It was unknown to you. You might have had a theory about it, and you might have believed the theory, but you did not have the experience, and the theory is not the experience. So it's the gate that opens that totally new state of consciousness, the first experience of the inner self, that spark within which we are ultimately. It's a state where there is no longer duality. There's not I and the eternal. That's two, isn't it? I am looking at something else. This is a state that wipes out duality. And you cannot be in that state all the time. It's not possible, not even with the adepts. But it's a realization that you never forget. In the voice of the silence, she says, when waxing stronger, thy soul glides forth from her secure retreat, and breaking loose from the protecting shrine, extends her silver thread and rushes onward. When beholding her image on the waves of space, she whispers, this is I. Declare, O disciple, thy soul is caught in the webs of delusion. Duality. It's secret because it has been unknown until experienced. When for a fleeting forever, that's a phrase a Zen master used, it's perfect because the experience is exactly that. It's eternity and nothing else, but it's fleeting because the mind wants to say, I've got it, and then you don't. Duality comes in, see? When for a fleeting forever, we are that self. There is no me. I speak from experience, and thousands can do the same. There is no me. There is no time. There is only the eternal. And the eternal is not progressive time. It is beyond time. It's that which always was, which always is, which always will be, whether or not there's a physical universe, whether or not there's anything. When that is touched, there is a great peace that comes. And we can repeat with Dame Edith of Norwich, I think it was, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. Were I to have a tombstone, that would be one thing I'd put on it, other than be back later. Now, it has been said in theosophical literature and confirmed by near-death experiences, that when we die, we get a flash of the life just lived. Thousands upon thousands have reported this. For a nanosecond, our whole life goes before us. I've not had this experience. I've not had the pleasure of dying yet. But some people that I know have had the experience, and they say they can't explain it because it's just a second or two at the most. And everything in their life passes before them. Now, it really isn't everything. I refuse to believe it's every time they scratch their nose. But it is every event in their life, I think. It is said by Blavatsky that when we are to reincarnate, at the moment of reincarnation, we get a flash of the life to come, and we cry. Now, just as that flash of the life to come is not the life you're going to lead, because you have to go through that life, you see. You just get a preview. Then it has to be lived, doesn't it? Just as that flash is not the life itself, so the first dawning of the inner self in your consciousness is a flash. And it's a long route until finally you are centered there. It's only gradually through challenging experience, we discover that we've entered the steep and thorny road. At first, we may notice we've become powerfully conditioned. We're usually unaware of our conditioning, really. And I speak to myself as well as you. We're usually unaware of it. We're like a cat that hisses at someone who has abused it. That's what we do. Somebody does something we don't like, they hurt us, and the next time we see him, we go, whoosh. Someone hurts us. We remember what they did. We meet them a week later, and we don't see them. We see our memory of what they did. See that? Don't you all? I'm not alone in this, am I? Am I the only one who does this? So we remember, and we see the image of them we have created from the situation that hurt us. They probably don't even know they hurt us. Most people are so busy thinking about themselves, they really don't think about other people. They may not know they hurt us, or they have forgotten it totally. We hold on to it. What a bore. It's that kind of thing that is a block on the spiritual life, in the spiritual life. Those reactions. So our mind and our emotions have been running us, though we're totally unaware of it, or we think our mind and our emotions are us. That's even worse. We don't realize that we have to be like the caterpillar. See, most of us want to be bigger and better caterpillars. We want the me to be better. That's nice. That's not a bad idea. Gee, I don't want to be so mean-hearted in the future. I want to be more understanding of other people. Good idea. Very good idea. But ultimately, that me, what we think is me, has to be dissolved like the caterpillar in order that the butterfly can be born, the inner self can be born. The crucifixion, to me, metaphor and myth, to you, maybe history, that's your business, not mine. The ego had to die on the cross. This is the cross, by the way. Had to die on the cross so that the inner God could be resurrected. It's, as Joseph Campbell said, he was mentioned in one of the talks, Joseph Campbell said, the hero with 1,000 faces. The same basic ideas are woven into different myths. And when you compare them all, that's one of the reasons for the second objective, to comparative religions, philosophy, and science, you begin to see that there's a thread that's common to a great many of the myths, told in a different way. So we've become conditioned, and we've identified with our emotions and our thoughts. But simply working within ourselves, within the me, to change ourselves, it might be helpful, but it's not sufficient. It's like changing furniture in the house. You know, you rearrange the furniture in the house. Gee, it looks a lot nicer. Same furniture, same house. No. As I said, you have to be like the caterpillar. House has to be burned down. I hope nobody takes this literally. Well, you know, we're a little bit like the two caterpillars having a nice conversation one day. One of them looks up and sees a butterfly, and he got sort of shocked. He says to the other one, "You're never going to get me up in one of them." Now, there's a story in the New Testament where the New Testament Jesus is with his disciples in a boat during a terrible storm. It's very frightening. Jesus is asleep. He didn't seem to mind. The disciples wake him up, and then he says, "Peace, be still." And everything is calm. Metaphorically, Jesus is the inner self. The disciples are our qualities, our emotions, our mind. They're in turmoil. Water has always represented the emotional world because the emotions are amorphous. They have no shape of their own. They take the shape of the thought, don't they? Water has also been used to refer to primordial chaos, chaos in the Greek sense of undifferentiated, homogeneous state. the pre-Big Bang void, the no-thingness. That's the chaos of the Greeks. So that has been taken also, symbolized by water, because it is formless. So the emotional world is all churned up, and when the inner self awakens, it's calmed down. Now, once we become aware of and identified with and know for certain from that experience of the awakening of the inner reality that we are that, it fades, of course. We come straight back to brain consciousness and have to deal with all the difficult people around us. We're never difficult, of course, it's always the others. And we have to deal with that. But we never, ever forget it. It closes fast behind the neophyte forevermore. You cannot forget it. Ever. I have many beliefs, like you, no doubt. I believe in reincarnation. I'm 98% sure there is such a thing as reincarnation, and I'm also 98% sure that Ed will never reincarnate. We can discuss that later. That's a belief based on evidence, I grant you. But that awakening of the inner self is no belief. That is a certainty, more certain than anything ever. Then, after we realize that, we must gain mastery over the mind and the emotions and the body. That is a gigantic task. Why? We have spent years, maybe many lifetimes, moving in a certain direction, and now we have to reverse it. Inertia is a fact. Not just a physical fact, it's an emotional fact. If you go to a party at night, and when you're younger, you maybe all did this at one point, and you stay up half the night. I never enjoyed that very much. I think I only once stayed up all night willingly. But anyway, you come home and you're all revved up, aren't you? You can't go to sleep right away because your mind is running and your emotions are running. Inertia, emotional, mental inertia. You have to calm down first before you can go to sleep. So it's the same principle. One of the great joys of theosophical philosophy to me is that you find a principle at one state of being and you find that same principle at every other state. Inertia, physical, emotional, mental. It's there. Everywhere you can look, you'll find inertia is a fact. So you have to overcome all that. K.H. explained that to Sinnott. He said self-purification is not the work of a few weeks or even a few years, but a series of lifetimes. So maybe we can forgive ourselves a little bit when we don't reach perfection in 2 weeks. I know some people who are quite sure they've done that. Some of them are politicians. So he said we must undo the effects of long number of years spent in objects diametrically opposed to the real goal. Now, if we long for union with the eternal, what must we do first, even before the trying to live the golden stairs? Blavatsky makes it quite clear in one of her letters to the American Convention. She wrote, I think, three different ones, and in one of them, she said the first thing is to become aware of our ignorance. We do not know. In The Voice of the Silence, again, she talks about the I doctrine, meaning the intellectual path, where you just use your mind and that light of the inner reality is not illuminating the mind. She says those folks say, this I know. But the doctrine of the heart, that is those who are operating from that inner self, not the emotional nature, which most people mean by heart. In Buddhism, the heart is the seat of wisdom, not the emotions. And The Voice of the Silence is a Buddhist book. So the doctrine of the heart, those folks say, those who have garnered low confess, those who have garnered low confess, thus have I heard. I say that to myself frequently. So, first thing, aware that we're ignorant. Next thing, be convinced that it's possible to find out. If I say, okay, I'm ignorant, but I can't do anything about it, well, you won't, will you? I mean, if somebody says, let's go play tennis, and you say, I can't play tennis, you can't until you try. Maybe you won't be very good, but you can probably hit the ball once or twice. You can do something. So first, accept the fact that we don't know for sure. It's not yet our experience. So far, it's our belief, a very reasonable belief, one that we want to follow, one that we want to pursue, and have the experience ultimately. But at the minute, we haven't had the experience. So we accept that. Then the firm conviction we can do it. And lastly, the indomitable determination to do it. In one of his letters, K.H. said, we must have an ironclad determination and yet be meek and humble. Strange combination. What is required is that spiritual will which will not give up. It's not stubbornness. It's not from the me. It's from a much deeper state. And that determination is the driving force that gets us to the heart of the universe, which is your heart, my heart, the one heart, the only heart, the unspeakable, unthinkable, sacred, eternal. It is a transforming experience to know that. And then to feel the pain of humanity and to want to do whatever you can to lift it. Armed with an indomitable determination to see ourselves as we are, faults and all, we can begin the long and arduous self-transforming journey. Unfortunately, there are no clear and detailed methods or maps. The teacher can but point the way. Look there. That's all. There are only guideposts that point toward the ultimate goal. No detailed map will do, because although the goal is the same for every human being, the route is unique to the individual. Why? Because the root is your life. Thank you.
You mentioned a hero with 1,000 faces and about and its relationship to the ego and duality. Will there always be a duality? Or are we moving, can we have a unity? Or is that?
There is always both unity and diversity. It's one of those paradoxes. H.P.B. talks about, the question of evil comes up in every philosophy, and it's the most difficult one to deal with in any philosophy or religion. And she says, primordial unity was rent asunder and the universe was polarized. So there's always two poles. There's male, female, there's up, down, there's night, day, there's positive, negative. Wherever you look, there's polarity. So there is duality. In the manifested world, there is apparent duality. But ultimately, it all resolves into a unity. The only time there will be true universal unity is in pralaya, when the universe disintegrates and all goes back to subatomic particles. The universe comes into being because there is polarity. It comes into being only because it's out of kilter in a way. You can think about that, but that it's the same with the, we are one-pointed in consciousness, we human beings. The adepts are too, because they're human. We can only attend to one thing consciously. We can do many things at the same time. The example I always give is when you were a child, you rubbed your stomach and patted your head. And when somebody first told you, you probably did what I did. You went bang, bang, bang. Then you had to think about it, and you paid conscious attention to this hand. Then you relegated that to the subconscious, though as a child you didn't know what you were doing. And then you put the then you paid attention here. Now I'm doing both, and I'm not paying attention to either hand. I'm paying attention to you. See? So you can. Consciously, you can only attend to one thing at a time. K.H., at one point, he talked about his student by the name of Jwal Kul, who lived nearby him and was a fellow Buddhist, by the way, not a Christian. And he said that while eating, K.H. said, while eating or reading or dressing, I am unaware of even my closest friends, because he was consciously attending to that, see? And he said last night, for example, Jwal Kul, you know, ran his nose to blood because he did something foolish and was hit something in the house he lived in. And K.H. said, I was unaware of it. And then he adds why? Because I was not thinking of him. Had he been thinking of him, he would have picked it up. Even I can do that sometimes. Sometimes I can know exactly what somebody else is thinking if I focus on them. That doesn't happen very often, and I certainly, you know, it's a rare event. But I have had the experience, and thousands have had the experience. So, but KH is also one-pointed. So while we're in brain consciousness, there's duality. Even the mind, she says there's only one mind. But then she talks about the higher mind and the lower mind, or buddhi-manas and kamma-manas. In incarnation, it appears dual. But really, the mind is one with two major functions, one to the abstract and one to the concrete. I don't know whether that helps, but that's... I always say I never give answers, I give my opinion.
I'm glad you brought that up. It's been a struggle for me all my life. I'm a Gemini, so. but I agree with that. In the existential condition is dualistic, and I don't think that's going to change. But within us, I mean, it seems to be the teachings do say that unity can be achieved in the inner worlds, and that's our task. And Jung, he made this statement, and I think the difference he said between psychotic people and the rest of us is that somehow normal people are able to hold the pair of opposites, the experience of simultaneously good and evil, both within and without.
Yeah, I did a talk years ago, The Still Point Beyond Good and Evil. Allegedly, Krishnamurti said this. I don't know whether somebody made it up or he really said it, but I always found it amusing. He said the difference between a sane man and a crazy, and a sane man and an insane man is that the insane man has one fixed idea, and the sane man has many fixed ideas.
I have a comment. I was thinking while I was reading the other day a little bit of Pisti Sophia, where she treats the process of emanation from the one, the two, the three being really the one, and the two also being an aspect of the one or duality. I was thinking that duality is really at a high level of spirit and matter is what can maintain the equilibrium in the one. So at a certain level of differentiation, it could become strings or view as streams. But in essence, it's really rooted also in the one.
Well, the theory is everything comes out of the one, the pre-Big Bang void, you see. Even science agrees with that, though they don't look at it in the way that theosophists do.
So this might not be a quick answer, but just in terms of consciousness, years ago when I was an undergraduate, I wrote a paper, and one of the things in my source material that I read over and over was The mystic and the schizophrenic are in the same ocean, but the mystic is swimming and the schizophrenic is drowning. And I would just like your take on that.
Well, I think insanity of any kind has all sorts of possible explanations. They say that, I can't think of the disease now, which is a disease of the mystics. What is it? Epilepsy. Dora Kunz, who was one of my mentors, and I'm eternally grateful to her because I learned to meditate in her classes. It's the pearl of great price, and the only way I can repay is to help others learn. So I facilitate meditation workshops, you know. As she said, that epilepsy had tore holes in the aura, and that made the individual more susceptible to possession or influence from outer sources. Sometimes schizophrenia, I think, is just the brain problem, and maybe mostly, and other times it's actually the mind itself, you know. So that when the brain dies, very often that person is free of the schizophrenia, you see. I saw a t-shirt once in New York, which I absolutely loved. It was, "Roses are red, violets are blue. I'm schizophrenic, and so am I."